We take up, therefore, the story of Cain and Abel. Notice on the board here, I put down something that I almost had last time, what it means to be human socially. Last time, I put on there, this is a primer, on what it means to be human personally. And just to summarize it, some of you were here, some not, but even for those who are here, it's good to summarize this narrative in 2 and 3, what it means to be human personally. Well, we said it meant, according to chapter 2, to be highly endowed by the Creator with the wonderful gifts that make us human. We have life, a home, an environment with all kinds of nice things in this creation. We have work, cultural activities, something important for us to do with our lives. We have freedom of choice. We have a community with non-human creation. And finally, we have human community. And that makes us human. That was chapter 2, the wonderful garden. He said it was almost utopian. In chapter 3 that we had last time, and we really had a lot last time, we could spend all 10 sessions that I was here on chapter 3, but we're trying to give you an overview here. Humans are also severely limited by the judge who has these ordinances spoken to the serpent. It's going to be different for you. It's going to be different for you to the woman. It's going to be different for you for the man. They are severely limited by the judge what to keep humans human, to keep us human. I called it the bitter medicine that makes us whole. If you'll excuse a personal remark, kind of an odd one, I'm always glad in Tacoma when our PLU football team loses its first game to its cross town rivals UPS because that's always the better medicine that makes them a better football team. If they win as they did so easily the last time, then they don't shape up. and I'm afraid that this is the bitter medicine, that we are limited. Sure, we have wonderful gifts by the Creator, but also we're limited, we're fallible, we blow it. And we live with what? Pain and sorrow and frustration. The thistles grow faster than we, and we have to have toil, the sweat of our brow, and we have to live with death. And that's also human life. And to leave that last part out would be not true. You see, I call all of these stories of the first part of the Bible prototypical. What do I mean by that? They are typical of human life and our relationship to our Creator from the beginning, the first humans, but also for us now. You see that? They're typical. So that I don't just say this is what happened to one man way back then, and to one woman. And today in our story, Cain is everyone who gets a raw deal from God. And who gets angry and traces things into his or her own hand. And so I think that we are too easily that we put these things way back then and we don't see them in their connection. Now I'm going to read here, just for the sake of, I usually have an introduction, something that I think might help us. And I've written this, get closer to the present story, where you'll notice I call this a necessary supplement to the Garden of Eden narrative. Not only what it means to be human personally in our relationship with God, but socially, when we humans stand alongside of other humans in society. And not only good things happen when we cooperate, but when we have rivalry and some get ahead and succeed the others, something is bad. So this narrative is a primer, I think, about interhuman relationships, especially when injustice is involved. It's something like the narrative that we had in the last two sessions, and it is a primer about humans, but it is not so much a primer on the relationship of humans to God, personally, but their relationship to God socially, over against other human beings. This is often forgotten, and religion becomes, in especially America here, purely personal, me and Jesus. Whereas there is an aspect of religion and our relationship to God, also with our relationship to fellow men. And that's why we have this famous story of Cain and Abel. What do we have here? Well, we have two brothers, equal sons of the same parents, each engaged in an important and worthwhile vocation. Cain is the farmer, and Abel is the shepherd grazing. Now that's good. We call that economics the division of labor, isn't it? And when it works out very, very well. One can supply the grain that's needed for sedentary life, and the other one can supply the domesticated animals that are also needed for sedentary life and everything that came from the animals. The tension in this story does not arise from the fact that one group of farmers doesn't get along with the shepherds. That can happen too. But it doesn't come either from the fact that they are religious and they both bring first offerings. Cain bringing a firstling of his living plants, a vegetable offering, which the Israelites had, other people too, and Abel bringing an offering of an animal of what he has from his flock. That's not the thing that causes the trouble. The thing that causes the trouble here is what?
The priest.
God, yes. God through the priest. I don't know just how it happened, but one thing is for sure, God accepts the one gift and the other one.
Why?
New English Bible says rejects.
Why did God accept them?
Pardon?
Why did God accept them?
Yes, we wonder why do some people succeed and others not. You see that? That's the point.
The condition of the heart.
That could be.
Some people think that because
pardon?
Cain's attitude was...
Yeah, well, that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's one... I'll be real frank with you. I don't accept that. Even though it's mentioned in Hebrews chapter 3, chapter 11, that by faith Abel offered a better sacrifice to Cain. That's okay for the New Testament. I don't mind that at all. And so I accept that provisionally. You see that? But this story, and I have to stay with this story if I want to do what I'm supposed to be doing... let it say everything it wants to say before I short-circuit it with the New Testament, Christ's sacrifice, and everything else that forgives all sins. I think I have to, that what here is, doesn't it say that? She really raised the question immediately, is why, isn't it? We ask that. That does not give an answer here. Now some of the ladies, I was talking in my other class, and some of the ladies in Parkland, and, they're pious ladies. I live in the same apartment with them. I love them. They disagree with me. On this story, they don't disagree with me otherwise. Basically, we agree. But one of them even said, no, Cain took from the fruit of the ground. It was all on the ground. It was all dirty and all that. I said, that's not what it means, you know. And that... well, see, you guys are really with Martin Luther. You know what Martin Luther said? Abel was a Lutheran, and he was justified by faith. Cain said, I'm the oldest, and I'm bringing the best offering, and here to kill an innocent animal, that's terrible. And so God will have to accept my sacrifice. Whereas Abel is a good Lutheran, and he says, well, I'm the second born, and I'm not bringing the best offering, but it's all I've got. And he's justified by grace through faith. So you've got good people on your side. But this is before the Reformation, and it's before Christ, and I think we have to kind of take it on its own terms. Because it will tell us two things that are important. How not only people who suffer injustice act, and how we act, but how God deals with injustice, especially when injustice turns to murder and kills someone, gets rid of them, and that you cannot do. So it's a very, very interesting story. So when human beings stand by, let me just finish a little paragraph that I've written here, alongside one another, the possibilities of their relating to one another can be both positive or negative. They can cooperate and really help one another by sharing in common life in society. Some may cultivate the arable land, and Cain was the first farmer, so he does that, bringing in the harvest of the seasons, domesticating plants. And we know that goes all the way back to Neolithic times, so these stories reflect the ancient world. Others, like Abel, can raise flocks, domesticate animals and herds, and that's a normal and a wonderful way. But there's also this other possibility when human beings, and let's not make this gender, you notice how I said that last time, it's not just two brothers, it could be two sisters, or it could be a brother and a sister and a brother. Do you see that? So I think we're talking about humans here rather than...
Not in those times, men were the only ones that counted.
Yes, that's right. But and that's for sure that this was formulated with brothers and brothers. But I think its implication is much, much wider than that. And at least I would... You see, I'm rewriting the Bible a bit. But I do that in the freedom of the Holy Spirit. And I don't mind doing that. So you've got these brothers equal in endowment, in honest industry. One person and one class succeeds, where another person, another class, another group fails. This happens all the time. And isn't that what tears society apart? Isn't that what we really have socially when people live together? And I think that's wonderful that here you have a story of one who is disadvantaged and who feels that he's gotten a raw deal, and he takes it into his hand and murders his brother. So the old idea of... Don't think that I don't like these ladies or Martin Luther. I like them very much. See, Martin Luther says this is where unbelief finally leads to. That you even murder your brother. So Cain is the first murderer because he was unbelieving in his heart. I'm quite sure that that's finally where this guy comes to. But at the beginning of this story, and that's why we better take up our Bibles now, nothing is mentioned of that at all. And God even warns him before it happens. You see that? And then he doesn't listen to the warning. So, do you mind reading the first two verses for us, please? Chapter 4 of Genesis.
Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of the sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground.
All right, let's stop just there for the moment. This is giving us the scene. A few things I'd like to point out, and then you can ask any questions you'd like. RSV has the translation, now Adam knew Eve, his wife. Okay, that's possible. You can also translate it in another translation, the man. Remember, Adam means the man, the one made from earth, knew his wife. And that's the sexual word here, to know. And it's more than just scoring, it's a full knowing with a person, as a person. And now notice the emphasis on the woman here. It's not begat, you know, the man. We'll have that in the genealogies in chapter 5. But here it's the woman. She conceived, she bore Cain. And she said, listen to this, I've gotten a man with the help of the Lord. I would like to translate this, and I hope you don't mind my pulling rank here, that like the Lord, I have created a creature.
I like that better.
Pardon? You like
that? I like that better.
You like that better. You're a little feisty. Well, she is feisty too, because, you know, she said, like the Lord creates, so I created too. It's the first human being, isn't it? And in triumph, she cries out, as mothers do, this is wonderful.
But she
everything.
Said, with the help of the Lord. So.
Yes. Or, you know, my translation is even a little more feisty. Like the Lord, you see that? You can do it. You know how Luther translated it? And even all Scandinavian Bibles, they translate it that way. Ich habe den Mann den Herrn. I've got the Savior, the one who's going to crush the head of the serpent. I've got the man, he's here. You see that? So she was the first believer. Get the idea? Well, eventually I think that's what it finally means. You see that? And I don't mind that in as a New Testament Christian. But I think that here is just her joy in the birth of the child. Now, if you want to translate, with the help of the Lord. See, the Hebrew is, I'll tell you what it is, Kornithi eth ish Kayin. Kornithi, I've acquired an acquirement. That's why his name Kayin is acquirement. The translation here is, I've gotten, I've achieved achievement. You see that? And so she's really emphasizing that. And then that F can be with the help of the Lord, or it could be the man, or with the help of the Lord, or that she actually thinks it's the promised Savior. You see that? Ich habe den Mann den Herrn. I've got the promised Savior right here. That's the way he translated. Well, let's leave that beside, because it won't help us too much in getting at what we want to get at. The next part, and again she bore his brother Abel. I think they were twins, because the Hebrew here is she continued to bear, as if the birth pangs set in again, and that then the second child is born. And the name of the second child isn't that important. It's that's what Abel means. It means breath. It's the word that you have in the book of Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities. Vapor of vapors. Everything is vapor. It all is vanity. And so his name is not that important. You see that? It's mm-hmm. And you don't think much. In fact, in the whole story, someone mentioned that one of these fellows in the staff that runs around, one of these mavericks, said, he doesn't amount to much in this story. I said, no, he only comes here to get killed.
Well, it's perfect, though, if he is a continued a second child, because she would have gone...
Yeah, she was a child. I pooped out. All right. let's stop that foolishness. Would you mind taking 3 and 4 and reading it for us, please?
After some time, Cain brought some of his harvest and gave it as an offering to the Lord. Then Abel brought the first lamb born to one of his sheep, killed it, and gave the best parts of it as an offering. The Lord was pleased with Abel and his offering. But he rejected Cain and his offering. Cain became furious and he scowled in anger.
All right. Well, here you have it. Now these, in the course of time, the two brothers bring an offering. And naturally, Cain does what? He brings the first of his fruit. This is not God told him, you've got to bring an offering. You see that? This is long before we have the Sinaitic covenant, Mount Sinai. Mm-hmm. This is what everyone does, at least did in antiquity. The Indians, would they, the Tlingit Indians, when they had their salmon, would they eat the first salmon? What did they have to do first?
Sacrifice.
Pardon?
I suppose a sacrifice.
Yes, there was always a gift to the god of the salmon. You see that? And you had to respect that. And this is the firstlings, the same thing of your first crops. The Israelites knew that. You couldn't eat your first apple from the orchard. That had to be put in a basket and given to the Lord. And then you could give the priest some and you could eat it. But that was first to be offering, the first fruits, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And people used to do that. That the firstlings belong to the Lord. And so he does it. And Abel does the same thing, the firstlings of his flock. And the fat, this seems to be the milk, although we don't always know that, or the fatty milk, whatever it is, as an offering. And now comes the inexplicable part, of which you ask the question, why?
Well, I notice here it says, and the Lord had respect unto Abel and his offering. That indicates something.
Yes, and the Lord had respect for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. First of all, let's go on the outside of this. How do you think they knew? How would an ancient Israelite telling this story or hearing this story, how did they know whether their sacrifices, they did it in the temple? How did you know whether your sacrifice was acceptable or not? Because it wasn't just automatic. It wasn't just magic. It could bring a sacrifice and it'll always be accepted. That's magic. If you came, first of all, to the temple, you had to be clean. Everything had to be clean, and or you couldn't even get in. If you had touched a dead body, your father, you had to stay out and go through ceremonies, get that uncleanness and everything done, and then you could come back. But now, once you slaughtered, cut the veins and so forth, and everything was there, how did they know whether it was acceptable or not? It wasn't just not automatic. Well, I think someone mentioned here, a priest was always there. And he would either say that it is tzaddik or rasha. This is righteous or wicked. And so it was dependent upon the word of God there. But how could you tell in the ancient days whether it was acceptable? You'd have to depend upon the priest. Now, how in this story do you think that they were thinking? It doesn't even talk about a priest. Maybe they assumed that.
They went to the Father.
Pardon?
They went to the Father. They brought it to him.
All right. They might have asked. But in Ezekiel, the sacrifice that is accepted by God rises, and God smells the sweet savor of the sacrifice. Whereas the sacrifice that he doesn't accept does not rise to him. Have you seen pictures like that in the old picture Bible history books? That it goes, some people say that. We don't know, you see that. But one thing is very clear from the story, and the story doesn't say much more about it, but that what? It's a fact. And one was accepted. The Hebrew actually says, and he did not look to Cain and his sacrifice. He looked at the one. Does that mean that Cain personally is rejected forever and ever?
Wouldn't it be just till the next sacrifice? Couldn't he try again?
Yes, he could. In fact, what happens in the very next part of the story? We better read that. Would you mind reading that? What happens in the next part of the story after his countenance, he's angry, and his countenance fell. By the way, just a question. What does that mean, his countenance fell?
Disappointed.
Pardon?
He was disappointed.
He looked disappointed. Sad.
He was pouting.
Yeah, and he looks down. He doesn't want to look up. Martin Luther said he doesn't want God to be God. There, I think he was right on.
It says something to me that he was mad at God, but he killed Cain.
Yeah.
Cain was mad at God. Because he was mad at God, he killed Abel.
Yeah.
I guess he didn't dare try to kill God.
Well, maybe it amounts to the same thing.
Kids do that. They get mad at their parents and hit the other kid.
Well, you see, the brother that got ahead of him and succeeded, that's the one that's really his rival. Mm-hmm. But doesn't that happen in society?
If the child thinks that the other child got more than his share.
Yes, right, absolutely. Or one class, or one people, and that's what tears society apart. So this social aspect is very strong. Okay, we'll let you read. Why not 6 and 7?
The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry?
and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. This desire is for you, but you must master it.
I think the Lord is a very good pastor here, don't you think so? He knows this guy's going off the deep end, and he goes and said to him, young man, you are getting into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So far from rejecting him, you see that, even though somehow he hasn't succeeded and the offering hasn't been accepted, he says, why is your countenance failing? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And the next part, if you do not do well, then sin is crouching outside of the door of your house, and when you come out, he will what? Pounce on you and get you, isn't that? Or you can translate, there's another way of translating it, that the demon of the dead, the murdered person, will pursue you all your life. You can take that as another possible translation. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. So someone said that here. He's still responsible, and he can't get out of it. What's the response? Would you continue reading, Mr. that was just reading the last time? Sorry, what's your first name?
Oh, Bob.
Bob, okay. Verse 8.
Verse 8. Mm-hmm. Cain said to Abel, his brother, let us go out to the field. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him.
All right. Just a comment that you might not think of. Many commentators, and I agree with them, feel that even though Adam and Eve had been, the man and the woman had been cast out of the Garden of Eden, remember that, and expelled, that when they went to bring those sacrifices, Cain and Abel, they went back in to that place, you see that? And that the reason why, this is an odd thing, let us go out of the field, is that he wants to somehow inveigle him so that he'll get him out of sacred ground, and he'll out there in the field, which is where he's been cultivating, you see that? That's where the murder takes place. In fact, if you'll notice that you read the RSV, the Hebrew doesn't even have that. He just spoke to his brother Abel, they argued, and then he killed him. But here, I think this is kind of nice because it's in a number of the ancient manuscripts there. And let us go out to the field. And then when they were in the field, then, and that's important because you remember he's the first agricultural man, and he's going to ruin the field. And the field won't give its strength anymore, you see that? So that's important. Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. It's not just when he rose up against Abel, but even his blood brother, he does that. So it's another human being and does that. Okay, let's go on to the next part. Would you mind reading that? Let's see, 9 and 10.
Okay, I'm Mary. And the Lord said unto Cain, where is Abel, thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, what hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground.
All right, any comments by you or questions? Is it all clear? He must have buried the body in the ground, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And now the Lord comes. Didn't he do that in the last story we had? 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he came back and said, where are you? And here God is present too. And he says, where is your brother? See?
Mm-hmm.
Notice how this is a social story. It's not, where are you personally in relationship to me? Where are you in relationship to me connected with your brother? See? Where is your brother? So God is present. And he said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? What does he mean by that?
Do you expect me to know where my brother is every minute?
Pardon?
Do you expect me to know where my brother is every minute?
Yeah.
I'm not in my
brother. Well, when there's a crime, do people lie? Do they cover up? Sure, they lie like everything, and that happens, and here you've got it. He very well knows it, but what's his excuse? Am I my brother's keeper? Who should be the keeper?
You, the Lord.
The Lord, yes. The Hebrew word here is, am I my brother's shepherd? you should be the shepherd of that shepherd that got killed. And you should take better care and shepherd me and all the rest of the world. And if you only ran the world right, we wouldn't have all this injustice around here. So this is really angry, isn't it? Well, we know this famous, isn't it? Am I my brother's
keeper? Blame somebody else.
Yeah.
It's a bad servant.
And especially blame whom?
The Lord.
The Lord, you shouldn't have made us the way you did.
We do that all the time.
Absolutely.
I used to do it.
Well, I think it's pathological if we don't.
Why did you let this happen?
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, how could you do that? And so it is, and don't we have that in this? And finally, they really did blame the woman whom thou gavest to be with me. She gave me to eat. You did it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by the way, you have to do that. You can't just only, and the Psalms don't only do that, say, I'm having trouble. If you do that, you have what the Germans call Weltschmerz. You're sorry that you're living. And it destroys people. They feel sorry for themselves. Blame the enemy, some people outside. I think if you want to be psychologically healthy, you have to face up to the reality of what is transcendent and what is God is beyond you. And to be healthy includes also complaining and accusing. We'll hear it later on. He does it really more than just at this point, but he does it here. Am I your brother's keeper? Lord says, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. So when nobody else hears and the crime seems to be covered over, I hear. The Hebrew word here is your bloods of your brother, all the drops of blood. That means whenever human blood is shed anywhere, it cries out to God to be the avenger. And God hears. There can be no perfect crime in God's world. Pardon?
He knows. Yeah. He knows.
Right? He knows. Yes.
He knows where he is.
Yeah. Well, and you know, we in our technological society, we'll just refer to it. We set off 2 atomic bombs, and Harry Truman, whom I really like, slept well after both times over defenseless cities. But what in the world is this? This is quite different than what we have here, isn't it? That God hears every drop of blood. That cries out, bloody murder, you know, that's what the Hebrew word here is, cries out, God cries out too, what have you done? And the blood cries out here. Well, let's keep on reading there. Would you mind reading there? The next verse, 11 and 12, next two verses. Mm-hmm.
And now art thou cursed from the earth, which hath opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. For thou tellest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth.
All right. So this is what's going to happen. He's not only polluted that ground which he had been tilling, you remember he was a farmer. And it's not, he can't continue as a farmer with God's blessing. And he is cursed from the ground. Now, remember last time, were the man and the woman cursed because you have done this and eaten of the tree of which I said to you, thou shalt not eat? Cursed, did it say, art thou? No, it said what? Cursed is the ground for your sake. But here, what happens in this case? It's so terrible that this curse actually hits Cain, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And you are cursed, yes, from the ground which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. So when you murder and shed blood and take away the life of another person and also rob God of his possibility of having a life history with that person, then you are doing something that is simply accursed with God. And so this is really strong.
Is that being cursed from the ground, is that the same thing as being cursed by God?
Yes, I think so. You are cursed. It certainly God's cursed, you see that? I think you're pointing out something really correctly. It's not quite as sharp as thou art cursed. You see that? You are cursed from the ground. And what does it mean here? It doesn't mean that he has no relationship with God, even though he'll go off and go east of Eden and have nothing to do with God. But he is cursed away from the agricultural land, don't you think? So he's a farmer. You're cursed, and when you till it, it won't give your strength. You just have no success as you've had. Question or comment?
Well, my translation says, now you are under a curse and driven from the ground.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it doesn't say, cursed art thou. I think that's where we're all agreed on that. You are under curse and driven from the ground, or you're cursed away from it. My idea would be that somehow this ground that he has polluted with his brother's blood, well, he can't cultivate it and expect to get decent crops from it. And that's why he'll leave, as we'll see. And in fact, he says you're going to be what? A fugitive.
Wander.
And a vagabond in the earth.
Maybe that's the beginning of the Israelites becoming nomads, really.
Well, in this case, a nomad, yes. In the case of the Israelites, they were really nomads. You're thinking of maybe the wilderness wandering, are you? Yeah, through the desert. No, I think that's a little different there. They were just getting toward the promised land, you see that. And that was a curse. It was a terrible place and so forth, but it wasn't necessarily a cursed place.
Well, how about before they went to Egypt? Weren't they shepherds then?
Oh, you're thinking then of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the patriarchs. Yeah, they're going from one place to another. They were fugitive, and they hadn't conquered the land yet, yes. In that sense, it's similar here. Right.
Cain was supposed to be the city builder, wasn't he? Did he go and build a city?
Later on, yes. We'll have that at the in chapter 7, on the same chapter, verse 17, that Cain knew his wife, she conceived Enoch, and Enoch bore the city to that. The old theologian said, like Martin Luther, well, he's going to build a city with a walled city, and he's going to protect himself and not depend upon God's protection, which should have been the sign that God put on him. That's the way. But that doesn't come until verse 17. So I think if you just take it here in its context here, he will no longer be able to continue as the farmer that he has with any success. Now, Cain, his response, give us, Dick, would you mind reading, that's quite a long section, 13 all the way through 15.
Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me away from the soil, and I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. Anyone who meets me may kill me." And the Lord said to him, "Not so. Whoever kills Cain will suffer a sevenfold vengeance." And the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him.
All right. I like this. We've been talking about it before. Cain's response. First, notice what he says. "I'm having trouble. My punishment is greater than I can bear." And then he has, we call that an I lament in the Psalms, where you talk about your own problems. Then comes the thou lament, really bites the bullet. Verse 14, we've talked about this all the way through this. "Thou hast driven me this day away from the ground. From thy face I shall be hidden." Maybe the Israelites had the idea that he can no longer live in the promised land, which has God's blessing. You see that he has to live way out there. And there were such people called Cainites, who were called descendants of Cain, who lived way out on the borders in Palestine, way out in the wilderness areas, the south of Judah and east of Judah. So I am driven away. "And from thy face I'm hidden. I'll be a fugitive and a wanderer, and whoever finds me will slay me." I mentioned this former student of mine that killed his father, and I visited him many times in Waupun, Wisconsin, in prison. First they put him in the psychological ward. And he said that he was a very good student. He's rehabilitated himself, and he remained a Christian, and his faith got him through the whole business. He's a librarian in Milwaukee now. But at that point, he said, this is a fool's paradise. And they wanted him to stand up in court and say that he didn't, that he was innocent. And the boy had the courage to stand up and say he was guilty. And so they took him from the fool's paradise, which he called the psychological area, and he liked the people, to the regular prison. And what goes on in the prison, I found out from him indirectly. And that is a terrible sort of life. He told me the whole story, and it's a long story. You know, when you kill your father, you can't redo that. That's something you can't really do. And it's a terrible sort of thing. And he said, you know, we prisoners, we've got the mark of Cain on us. And I said, you got that wrong, Joel. The mark of Cain is the mark of protection here. You see that? Mm-hmm. Because here it says what? Anybody that finds me is going to kill me. And the Lord says, not so. Everybody today wants every murder to be what? Killed, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that is, we'll have that in chapter 9. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, under certain limited circumstances, by man shall his blood be shed. And it's also in Exodus 21. But in this prototypical story, which is one of the foundational stories, the Lord has another way with dealing with the results of injustice. And what is it? He put a sign on him. What do you think that meant? A mark. It's not what the people think. We have a record as a con and we'll never get into society again. Mm-hmm. That's the way they say it. And perhaps true from their viewpoint. But what does it mean here?
Well, they can't touch him because he's not smart.
That's right. How would you think the Israelites thought that a person who was under the Lord's protection had a mark? How would you know that? Well, we don't know. It was perhaps a tattoo. We know this, that in the book of Ezekiel, before Jerusalem would be destroyed, that the angels put a mark on those that had not been idolaters and protected them. And the mark was a tau, a tub. It was the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which, by the way, just by coincidence, that's really coincidence, was written that way. Mm-hmm. And so the old theologians, they said, this is a mark, a sacramentum. This is a sign that is put on the forehead of everyone that is really should die to show that they are protected. And that's the sign that we get when we're baptized. And that, of course, what I had to tell this Christian boy, that the mark of Cain is your baptism. And I must say, he accepted that. And it was one of the great things in his rehabilitation. By the way, his rehabilitation was not easy. When you live in prison with all the homosexuals and you're a young, unprotected young man, this is just terrible, especially when you're too bright for your britches, the way this boy was. And that was a tremendous thing. But this idea that God, you mentioned it right, that he's under the protection of God. He's God's protege. In fact, doesn't he say, if anyone slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken upon him sevenfold, isn't it? What does that word sevenfold mean? We're going to have it in Sundays. What?
Many times.
Many, many times, yes. Transcendent. Remember we said the idea of seven is that most objects in the world are like a cube. They have a top and a bottom and a front and a back and a right and a left. And even I have that. If I stand here level on the top and the bottom and the right and left and front and back. That's the way our children draw pictures, isn't it? Frontality and all this. This is a way of perceiving. But the seventh dimension is transcendent. I think that's where it comes from. So you're right. Limitless times. And then Jesus Peter asked, how many times must I forgive my brother? And Jesus says what? 70 times 7. Yeah. Well, we'll have 70 times 7. It occurs on this chapter later on with another Lamech here. But here, if anybody touches him, so what does God do? This is a very interesting thing. Is he going to just let vengeance take its course. And, you know, when you have these blood feuds in Kentucky Mountains, families after families and families and killing and killing and killing, and we have this in societies, don't we? In nations and so forth, and they've got grudges and they've got to get it back. Vengeance is, oh, very strong. The whole Lebanon business.
We have the kind of cartoons for the children, too.
Yeah.
They're all on the vengeance, most of all that I've watched.
Yeah.
On the vengeance theme.
Well, you know what the Bible says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. You trust God to find the right things. And here, I think, let me ask you this, maybe to get closer. How did they treat murderers in the ancient, underneath the covenant in Israel?
Stone them.
Well, two ways. If it was an unpremeditated murder, and the elders would have to decide, and they would decide that, then he would have to live in a certain city. He couldn't stay where he had been, because he had shed blood, you see. And then when the high priest died, which is surprising, then from those cities of asylum, he could go back home. So that was it. If he was actually a murderer and it was obvious, then he was killed. So they had that sort of thing. Here, it's not told precisely how they're going to do it, except that God does do what? Protects even those who don't deserve the protection. This goes farther, therefore, than Israelite law. And the Israelites, when they read that, said, boy, he lets them get away with it. Which is rather surprising in this story.
It would be exile, though.
Pardon?
It would be exile.
Oh, yes. And he is a fugitive. He's not going to be able to stay there and continue his work. And he'll be a fugitive and a vagabond. And I suppose, see, that's what Joe told me, too. He said, you know, when you... break the laws of society, then society is against you in every way. And I went to visit him in the halfway house in Oshkosh and met a lot of his friends and other people. And you'd be surprised how those people think about society. In other words, I guess what we're coming to is how do we deal with, well, let's talk about America, 1990. How do we deal with murder? How did we deal with rehabilitation? Should we have capital punishment? Here in the state of Washington.
It's a murderer that gets the breaks in our society.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of mornings do we this morning?
No.
We would never finish. We get into a discussion of capital punishment.
Yes, yes.
We might be here all day.
Yes.
Well,
I think, however, this much we could agree on in the short time that we have. That it's also in our society an unfinished business.
Yeah.
Now, I really respect Joe Brecky for standing up in the court in Hurley, Wisconsin, and saying I was guilty.
Yeah, a lot of moral courage.
Yes, he did. And I think it helped his rehabilitation. You see that? That he took God seriously. And it's a long story. It wasn't easy. And nevertheless, I think that is a possibility. And there are other possibilities that God would have. See, this is not the end of it. The way the story ends is that next verse, then Ken went away from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Well, remember we talked about Eden being way off at the margin, and this is even east of Eden. Doesn't Steinbeck have a book called the novel
of Eden.
East of Eden, where anything can happen, no law, no order, everything, and that's where is the land of Cain, it's a terrible place. When the first explorers came to Labradoris, places that were terrible, you could hardly live, they would say, "This is Cain's land," isn't it? That's what they would talk. It's far away from the Holy Land. But he still carries on him what? Protection. That's very interesting.
You know, it's sort of a sign, probably not related, but when I read this about putting a mark, it reminded me of one of the madmen of our age who put the mark on the Jews in Germany, too, the other war that star of David.
Yeah.
Yes.
6 million or whatever number, so that they were identified, but for a different kind of purpose.
Yes, absolutely. Didn't the king of Denmark, when they were trying to find the Jews and expose them, himself go riding with a Star of David? And all the rest of the people in Copenhagen did what? Put the Stars of David on them, that we are Jews, we identify with. So there's the idea of a sign and of a mark, yes. Mm-hmm.
The different tribes in Liberia, they go through the Bush school training, that they're always given a certain mark, identifies their tribe. And sure. It was helpful for them when they'd go through the checkpoints on the road, especially during the rebellion. If they had a mark that identified them as a neutral tribe, they were all right. But if they didn't have any mark on them at all,
they weren't permitted. That's a very good idea. I think it's something like that. You can see it in Jerusalem if you go very early in the morning to the vegetable market. And the Bedouin ladies who sell vegetables have the tribal marks. And so I think that's what they're thinking of. And there was one mark that would show that you were a Kenite, a descendant of Cain. And I think that's where they understood this quite well. Well, we have a little time, thank goodness. The other time, class, we got into all kinds of things we never finished. But any more questions and comments? Because we've really, I can't settle this whole thing except, well, I'll tell you the final thing would be Romans chapter 3, where the Apostle Paul talks about the sacrifice of Christ, that in former times, the things which God had forbearance and overlooked when there were all kinds of injustice and sins. Now, once for all in the sacrifice of Christ, God has put that aright. Now, that would be, I'm quite sure, the center of any Christian. If I had to preach on this in a Christian community, that's what I would bring in. And I wouldn't mind bringing in the aspects that you talked about. Faith, you see that. That's what Hebrews does. But I do like to first take the Old Testament on its own terms as the Israelites would understand it, and only then take it as we would take it now with the Messiah having come in Jesus and in that his sacrifice. Yes?
This is getting ahead a little bit. I guess we won't be here tomorrow now. In 17, it says Cain knew his wife. But at this point, we haven't heard about any daughters or anything.
Oh,
and I know... Pardon?
They weren't worth mentioning.
Well, okay, but then in the next chapter says something about the days of Adam after he became the father's death was 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters.
Yes, he begat sons.
But the fall is after that. You read it, but you get this part about his wife.
Yeah. That. Here it merely assumes that. You see that?
Okay.
Yeah, it merely assumes that. I don't think that these particular narratives are put on a chronological line. In fact, there is quite a bit of evidence here that these stories, before they got in the written form that we had, I think most of the Bible was told orally. And then when it was put into written form, it wasn't all put together by one writer. There were a number of writers. So we don't have an eyewitness here, you see that. This is a traditional story. That's a very good point. Why don't I put something on the board here? Someone in the other class asked me about it, and I said, we don't have time to go into it, but here I do. If you said the original story, let's call them prototypical stories, stories that are there, if you have original events, whatever it was, in pre-Abram times, that's as far as the Israelites' memory would be, pre-Abrahamic times, then orally these stories were told for a long time. See that? From that time until, I suppose, Abraham, and then after the Israelites, let's put down Moses, they make their own nation, and finally they come in and settle in the land. Let's put David here, and if we can put dates here, dates are pretty well. Then finally they put it in the written form here. And there perhaps were two written forms, one made in Jerusalem, and that's where this story perhaps comes from, because they use the name Yahweh for the deity. And the other one was perhaps other stories, not this story, but other stories, were made by the priests in exile when they were getting ready to come back from exile, and they needed a scripture. And they combined these together in a compilation, and so that that seems to be the likely background of this. This sometimes puzzles people because they kind of assume that the story that we have here is an eyewitness account. I'm quite sure it tells us everything we need to know, but it is not necessarily an eyewitness account. Even if you take something in the New Testament, and that's not that many years, remember when Luke says at the beginning of his gospel, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as they were handed down by those who were eyewitnesses and who were servants of the word, so it seemed right to me, O Theophilus, having investigated these things for some time, to write an orderly account, so that you may know the surety of the things in which you've been instructed. So Theophilus was a candidate for baptism, and he had to be instructed. But the stories that Luke writes are a compilation of things that had been there before Luke, and even came from eyewitnesses and ministers of the word going back to Jesus. And so I guess what I would simply say in response to your comment is that the Bible was perhaps spoken before it was written, and it wasn't all written at one time. You see, a book in those days was a scroll, and so you had various collections. And scholars have worked really hard at this to try to see ones, but that would be kind of the majority view, that these stories are very ancient stories about the beginnings of history. I like to call them prototypical. But they're more than just what happened way back then. They're also what happens now. It was a Wilhelm Fischer, a German scholar, said that if ordinary history book is something like taking the events of the past and writing about them, and it's something like taking grapes and making wine out of them, these stories in Genesis 1 to 11 is like taking wine and making brandy or a liqueur, that you even take the essence of them. In other words, they're heavier meaning, because they cover everything. Now, I don't know in what respect, but I'm quite sure I am Cain in whenever I suffer injustice, and I want to take that into my hands, and I want to solve all this. I don't think that justice can ever be done. I certainly was for the civil rights movement and things like that. I was involved in very heavily years ago when I was in Chicago. And I know that whole thing personally very, very much. I think we must do that. But at the same time, I always realized, especially after I got in farther than I knew I could get into and be responsible for, and saw others do things that I couldn't be responsible for. When the weathermen in Chicago broke all the windows downtown, then I said, wait a second, what are you in? Do you see what I'm getting at? To establish justice is something that I think has to look toward the future. But I think we have a perspective in the risen Christ that calls upon you and me to have justice and to do justice. And when we take up problems like this of what are we going to do with murderers and how are we going to rehabilitate them, we have other alternatives than just to get rid of them and sweep them underneath the rug. Because that's the prison that I saw in Waupun, Wisconsin. The society just gets rid of them, you see that. And that's all. Or almost all. Well, I guess we've run out of our time here. Anyone wants to continue this, fine. We'll continue tomorrow. We're going to have the cultural achievements of humankind.